Texas Talking Out.
What was that that you said?
Texas Talking Out.
Gonna hoop upside your head.
Texas Talking
Out. Tell me, who can you trust when Texas guys are Texas
guys? Welcome to Tribcast. This is Steve Murdoch, and based on our current demographic trends, it is only a matter of time before a majority of Texans listen to this broadcast. And then now, here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast. It is the third week of March, and joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Editor Emily Ramshaw.
So am I last because we're having an equal pay conversation here, and you don't think the woman in the podcast should get to be introduced
your
first?
Your time's up.
To be fair, I think you're a very good negotiator.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I think you're busy.
I
despite being busy,
even though I'm
you
busy,
found time to be here.
I negotiated my pay.
We'll see how you do, and maybe we won't mention you last on the outro at the end.
Okay.
Is there an outro still?
I provide it.
I hope it's soon.
Yeah. how about now? Yeah. Does now work for you?
Well, since Emily brought it up, maybe she can brief us on the growing issue of equal pay in Texas.
Well,
Yes, earn your salary, Emily.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Exactly. The Wendy Davis campaign has been increasingly beating the drum around women's issues, and I think the latest strategy has been around equal pay. Davis sponsored the Lilly Ledbetter Act when it was coming through Texas, the Texas version of the Lilly Ledbetter Act that Governor Perry eventually vetoed, even though it made its way through both chambers. She has gone on the offensive against Abbott, saying as Attorney General, he defended the state against an equal pay lawsuit, arguing that a lot of his disciples have not exactly been, pro equal pay for women. And the latest is their allegations that the Attorney General's office has not provided equal pay for the top women in its ranks under Abbott's leadership.
The Abbott campaign countered this by saying that one of Wendy Davis's public sector clients of her law firm, she defended them against an equal pay lawsuit, and she's been working both sides of this thing. But, this is clearly an issue and clearly ground that the Democrats want to fight on and that the Republicans don't want to fight on. This is a completely Democratic frame.
And it's day five or day six of this story.
It's not like the missing airplane, though. It's not like it's,
no, I know. Seriously.
We woke up, we're still
because we
going,
actually know right. something about it. Yeah. The equal pay issue took a sharp left turn and disappeared into a – no, look, I think the fact that the story is still a story is testament to at least two things. The fact that it's gotten traction is a credit to the people who've pushed it, not just the Davis campaign, but that side. There's been more message discipline than we've seen in the campaign so far, which I think, there's a new communications person on the Davis campaign who came from, I believe, Harry Reid?
I think that's right, yeah.
And whether or
his
not
office.
This is a sign from his from his office. Not like
he sprang
like
from his head like Zeus.
He came from Harry and David.
Minerva.
And he actually brought a very nice package of dates with him. He came from Harry Reid's office. And whether or not this is a sign of the speaking of sharp left turns, whether the communication staff has made a sharp left turn and is now heading into a better patch in terms of how they execute remains to be seen. But at least there's been message discipline on this issue. But I think the second thing is the Abbott campaign has not spiked this, has not done a good job over the last couple of days in making this issue go away. And whether the surrogates who were put out to speak on this issue, the woman from Red State Women, Christman is her name, or Beth Kubrial from the Republican Party, whether they were people who the Abbott campaign put out to address this issue or whether there were people who went out on their own to address this issue.
I think it's the latter. And I think that one of the things that's been interesting here is how opportunistic in a way that's beneficial to them the Davis campaign has been. They're distinctly – their tone is much more aggressive. They've been –
The Davis campaign did not cause the Abbott campaign to fumble the ball as the ball has been fumbled so far.
But you need to back up and explain how those two – women fumbled the ball. I think getting back to Ross's point about how Democrats want to fight on this and Republicans don't, I mean, if they're representative, then it just shows that Republicans sort of don't know exactly how to fight on this because their arguments have been problematic, to say the least.
They've been klutzy. The responses have been klutzy and have actually kept the story alive and made the story
national.
As of Morning Joe this morning, where they were openly mocking the Abbott campaign and openly mocking Republicans for what they have said.
So, but what were their klutzy
responses? Let Ross talk about that. Yeah.
So Red State Women started as an effort by some conservatives to, you know, encourage women to go with the Republicans in Texas, just sort of a generic thing.
And women shouldn't just support Democrats. Right. We, too, have a campaign to get women.
We're going to play for these voters. And they came out, I guess they announced themselves last week, and as part of their announcement tour, Kerry goes on WFAA with Jason
Kerry
Wyman.
Is Kerry Christman, right, who is the head of Red State Women.
Executive director. And went on WFAA's Inside Politics on Sunday and talked about this and was asked by Jason Whiteley, what do you think about this equal pay issue? And she said, I don't think that we need the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Women are very busy right now. And that was the moment in the quote that everybody on the Democratic side grabbed, that women are too busy to pursue
it
this.
It became
issue.
A hashtag on Twitter, right. You know.
They're seeking higher ed degrees.
So that takes off. And then the second round, which Evan's referring to, is Beth Kubrio from the Texas Republican Party was on YNN, I guess, Paul Brown's show.
Yes.
And said that, you know, women need to be better negotiators when they're talking about their salaries, but we don't need a Lilly Ledbetter Act.
Which, of course, is not what the Lilly Ledbetter Act was about. Well, what it was about was it was a legal mechanism, as I understand it, right? It was not really about equal pay.
All of this,
so much
but in both cases, you're putting the onus for the lower pay on the woman herself.
Right. And if you're talking about equal pay for women and your line from your governor is and from your attorney general is, I believe in equal pay for women. Lilly Ledbetter Act is not the way to get there. That doesn't really comport with these lines that these two are dropping. And so they've got all this noise on their side. The Davis campaign has pounced and controlled the week.
It reads as if the Abbott campaign was caught flat-footed mm-hmm. on this issue.
I think that's right.
And honestly,
or they certainly act
if you're looking at the way this campaign was going to play out, and you go back a couple months ago, you had to know that this issue can come up.
Well, the Wendy Davis folks,
how could you get caught flat-footed?
Yeah, I mean, they've really effectively pivoted. I mean, you know, again, she was playing defense earlier on around her biography, and I think the only successful way you could spin that message is to turn it around and say this is an attack on me as a woman, and this equal pay stuff has fallen, you know, right into that category and allowed them to really aggressively take that position.
It's the second one too, because the Ted Nugent stuff opened the door to this
right.
conversation.
Which was also at least 6 days of news.
And so I want to ask a broad question, if I can, about that. So Nugent plus the equal pay stuff, which is the Abbott campaign taking this race as seriously as they should? Because these unforced errors are the kinds of unforced errors you make when you don't really view your opponent as serious. You had to know going into the Nugent thing that Nugent was controversial. You had to know going into this issue that it was going to come up. And you had to have better talking points prepared to push back on it. And they've just seemed kind of not prepared for any of this.
Well, no worse prepared than Davis was for the obvious attack on her bio.
Or her ethics, which drove the conversation for a whole week last week.
Right. But the assumption was that the Davis campaign was not ready for primetime, fair or unfair. The assumption was that the Abbott campaign was a well-oiled machine, $30 million in the bank, Dave Carney and team in place.
I never bought that.
See, but I actually thought that the idea that the Abbott campaign was going to make unforced errors, this was said by opponents of Abbott, I thought the Abbott campaign is going to just basically be very cautious, not do things that are going to get them into trouble. All they have to do is essentially run the clock out on this, and the math's going to work in their favor. And it's a Davis campaign that has the burden not to make unforced errors,
but
not the Abbott campaign.
You're getting mad at them for being cautious.
I'm not mad at anybody.
He's being cautious, yeah.
I'm not mad at anybody.
I mean, not mad.
I think from a journalism standpoint, it's like no, I'm not mad even for a moment. I think
now you're mad that we said you were mad.
Well, I'm mad at you always. So. But no, I don't think that they're being cautious.
No,
I think
his answer to the Lilly Ledbetter question was very cautious. It was like, I support equal pay. I don't know if that's the right thing, but we'll think about it.
There's no reason women should be paid less than men and on.
It was a very cautious answer. And that's what opened the door to like, attack. To my mind,
that's actually not caution. To my mind, that's you got to have an answer for this.
We're still in the stage of
the whole thing. The whole thing has been klutzy.
We're still setting the table for this race, and they're still putting the issues out for this race. And the Davis campaign is clearly going to talk about women's issues and women's place in public policy and those kinds of issues as this goes on. And they would like to talk less about abortion and about the filibuster as an abortion bill and more about sort of general women's issues. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at numbers in all the polls, our polls and everybody else's, to say, you know, women on average are Democrats. And if you can get them to vote, then you might stand a chance. The Abbott campaign is going the other way and talking about, you know, this should be about ethics and competence and those kinds of things and who we really are. And I think part of what we're seeing here is that neither of these candidates has run a big-time statewide campaign. Abbott's run statewide several times, but he's never been in the center.
It's a down-ballot race.
He's never been in the center ring with all the lights on. And I think both these candidates are acting like this is their first big time.
But the people are but again, I'm making a distinction between the candidate and the campaign. The people who are running the Abbott campaign have a ton of experience running statewide campaigns with the spotlights on them. Well, and this is unlike how they've typically behaved.
Yeah, but look how many campaigns that Rick Perry ran, and look at all his unforced errors. I mean,
well, the difference between a national campaign and a statewide campaign, I think, is what Ross is getting at, that there's a difference between a campaign at the top of the ticket and a campaign that's further down back.
Well, and the people that you're talking about having great experience in this stuff are the people who ran Rick Perry's campaigns, and they had the advantage in those campaigns, at least for the last, you know, 13 or 14 of them, of a very experienced candidate, a guy who knew, you know, kind of knew what he was doing and was comfortable on stage in front of even hostile crowds on the Jimmy Kimmel show. So I think Abbott and Davis are finding, you know, sort of their comfort zone, figuring out how they're going to run this. I still think we're setting the table both for the issues that are going to be in this race and for the way the candidates are going to behave. They're learning how to fight each other.
And I think the ethics stuff, which is where the Abbott people are going to push back on this equal pay stuff, at least that's been the strategy as of today as we sit here, is to push back and say—
Right, hashing up her legal clients again.
I got to tell you, I think that's got less traction. It's harder to understand. I think the casual person listens to it.
I don't think so.
Oh, I do. I think you can write these.
You don't
think the average voter says public sector client, and it's like.
I think neither of you are casual people.
It didn't work with Mark Shelton, who went after Wendy Davis in that race on almost a purely an ethics. I mean, all these allegations against her have come up before.
I think mean to women is a lot easier to process if you're the average person than public sector client. Recuse herself.
Right.
I mean, I just think that's a harder argument. It sounds like more of an insidery argument than mean to women.
Does it matter how much the substance of the Davis attack on Abbott's AG's office ultimately holds up? You know, it looks like there are many state agencies that don't have many highly paid women, not just the AG's office in Texas. Will that ultimately detract from her messaging, or is it more just about they've raised the issue and there's enough there that it's up to the Abbott people to respond better?
I think if you'd looked at any state agency under these circumstances, not just Abbott's. I mean, I think, you know, again, you can hold Abbott accountable for this because he was the one at the top of that agency for the last X number of years, 12 years. You know, I would say you'd probably look at almost any organization in Texas, any agency in Texas, and you would find maybe nationally and see the exact same trend.
But Peggy Feacock has a story in the Express News today that says that on average women in the Attorney General's office that a certain
top tier
are paid less than men. Now, that may be a true fact. It also may or may not be a fact that is in need of some context internally or that office compared to other offices. But the fact is that's the story that ran the Express News today. That's what's getting a little bit of heat on social media today. And ultimately what that does is extend the already long tail of this story even longer.
It's not going to help him politically that any other agency did this or that some agencies are much worse than his because he's the only one running for governor.
Right.
Well, one of the things that we were hoping to talk about today, I think, was the lieutenant governor's debate, but it's not going to happen since the debate didn't happen.
Only one sock showed up for the sock puppet show. Ava Dewhurst showed up and Dan Patrick didn't.
And so how'd that go down, Ross?
The C Club in Houston has a closed Republican meeting every so often. I think it's monthly, but I'm not sure of that. And they invited Patrick and Dewhurst to come debate before the C Club. And both of them, knowing that it was a closed meeting, apparently said, yeah, I'll do that. And then when it came out that this was, came out publicly that they were going to have a public, they were going to have a debate private in this runoff and that the public couldn't come and that the media couldn't come, Dan Patrick said, I think you should open it to the public. And then David Dewhurst said, I think you should open it to the public. The club said no. Dan Patrick said, I'm out. So David Dewhurst did it alone.
And his communications guy tweeted that he won, hands down.
Well, must be present to win.
Do we think that that is the reason Dan Patrick dropped out? Or do we have to take him at his word on that?
I think there's no reason not to. I mean, he's got, there's all kinds of advantages to this. You sort of win the free media without having to risk, appearing in a debate. I think the group is going to endorse in about a month. And I think there was some sentiment among the Patrick people that this group is probably going to endorse Dewhurst. I don't know that they're going to.
So you think that's why this law went down?
Well, I mean, there's just a bunch of stuff that's there. I mean, let's take him at his word. Let's take him at, you know, he wanted this to be public. It wasn't, so he dropped out. But there are some ancillary benefits here. One of them is that, you know, he's appearing before a group that he thinks might be David Dewhurst's group. It's a group that's, you know, made up of people who have largely already decided what they're going to do. They're more interesting if you're a candidate as in the finance primary than in the voting primary. These are people with money. There's not that many votes in the room, but there's a lot of wallets. So I think a lot of that plays, but I think Dan Patrick figured, you know, purpose has already been served. Without me doing this debate, I'm not going to do the debate. Goodbye.
And it hits a note that resonates with the people that cover him.
I wonder if Patrick's approach to this is, I am in a significant lead over Dewhurst going into this runoff. And the challenge for Dewhurst in the next 2 months is so formidable that I don't really need to do joint appearances with Dewhurst. I don't really need to be out there. What I need to be doing is effectively taking a victory lap. I need to be collecting
late train fundraisers.
I need to be donors. Pardon me. I need to be collecting support from the campaigns that are out of this race, from the Staples and the Patterson folks. I need to be doing that. I need to be basically building bridges a little bit, right? I don't need to be attacking Dewhurst, because ultimately the math on this runoff is so formidable for Dewhurst to overcome that something really seismic is going to have to happen for me to lose. And so maybe there's more risk in appearing alongside Dewhurst than
and
not.
And does it hurt him at all if they never show up together, if they never have a debate? Well, I think they might have something scheduled together.
It does if they never have a debate, because, you know, that Ted Cruz showed you what happens if you never have a debate. But, you know, you can have enough debates.
Yeah, but is Dewhurst in the position at this point to say, to use that, Dan Patrick won't debate me, as a billy club against him? And will the people – look, we
this
know –
this is a public guy. He's got a radio show, and he's afraid to be on a stand with me. He's scared. He's not going to debate. Dan Patrick, the hero of the right wing.
I'm looking forward to the Ross Ramsey-Evan Smith debate.
Ross,
here's the deal.
You talk a lot faster than Dewhurst does, Ross.
Here is the deal. 72% of the people in this primary voted against Dewhurst. He only got 28%. Patrick got 41%. So if you assume that there's 59% who did not vote for Patrick, then Dewhurst needs to get as many of those people as possible to get above 50 in the runoff. If he got every single person who voted for Staples and Patterson and every single person who voted for him in the primary, that's 59%. If you didn't vote in the primary, you can't vote in the runoff. The universe of potential votes for him, if you assume that all the people who voted for Patrick who vote are going to vote for Patrick again, the universe of potential votes for him in this runoff is not very
pretty
great.
Small, right?
And you'd have to believe that some of the Staples people are not going to jump over and vote for Patrick. You'd have to believe that some of the Patterson people are not going to jump over and vote for Patrick. And you'd have to believe that some of the Patterson and Staples people are not just simply going to stay home. The task for him is pretty significant.
Right.
So he can beat up Dewhurst, and pardon me, Patrick, for not getting in a debate with him. He can spend a whole lot of his family's money in this runoff. And he, you know, there's a question as to, did he spend enough of his own money in the run-up to the primary? Is he going to
spend enough of anybody's money?
Is he going to then turn around and spend it in the runoff? But for him, the task is I'm not sure that from Patrick's standpoint, pulling out of this debate is necessarily a bad move strategically, because he's the one in the catbird seat.
I think pulling out of this debate was probably fine. I think if he pulls out of all the debates, that's a different issue.
Meanwhile, should we be celebrating the victory for public debates?
What in the hell is he talking about?
You know, like, I mean, a victory for having
Patrick,
these events in
Patrick
the media?
Struck a blow for keeping those doors opened.
I don't think anybody really thinks this was about that, was it?
No, and I'm not sure that there's a giant clamor for debates from these guys.
Both these guys accepted an invitation that the club says they knew was for a private gathering.
The four of them before the first round, you know, it was like every other night they had an appearance together. You know, it's not
and
that it we haven't heard the views of these people.
It was almost the same thing every time.
We haven't seen them on stage together. I think we'll see these two on stage together a couple of three times.
Could actually simulate right here.
Probably could,
like,
do
like an old radio play.
You want to do it?
You be Patrick, I'll be Dewhurst.
Call him off like.
You be Patrick. Tell me I'm incompetent. Tell me that I created Wendy Davis. Tell me that I flip flopped on immigration.
Right.
I'll be Dewhurst. And
what will you say?
You're a liar. I'll say you're a liar.
He was eloquent, wasn't he?
The ratings for this podcast are just going through the roof right now.
You know,
I think Evan's version of me doing Patrick was better than Evan's version of Evan doing Dewhurst. Yeah.
Let's move on. While we're on the topic of Republican infighting.
Notice that Emily didn't have a role to play in that debate, you sexist.
We have an equal time problem now.
We do, yeah.
Sorry, I was checking my email.
You could be Jerry Patterson in the background, just...
grumbling?
Yeah, hiring investigators.
Hiring investigators. Yeah, on the phone with your investigator. Ross, I didn't ask you to be part of that debate.
Right, exactly.
There was an interesting thing that happened yesterday. Michael Quinn Sullivan, who is the head of the Empower Texans group, which has a political action committee that has given a lot of money to Ken Paxton, who is running for attorney general. Sullivan is also a contributor to Breitbart Texas, which is the Texas vertical for Breitbart.com, which is a conservative website. He emailed the Branch campaign, which is Paxton's opponent, and said, hey, I'm on a tight deadline. I have these questions. Pro-lifers have accused you guys of putting an amendment that would have been not very pro-life back in 2005. And it didn't specify.
They were saying it had something to do with third trimester abortions. Right.
Yeah. But and so instead of – and we can get into that. But instead of responding to Michael Quinn Sullivan, Dan Branch – his campaign
through his spokesman
Enrique Marquez just put out a huge press release being like sort of it was pretty staid language wise but it was like this guy's acting like a reporter, we don't really buy it, but here's sort of what this attack is all about. And
by the way, the organization that he leads endorsed Ken Paxton, Dan Branch's opponent,
and gave him a ton of money,
more than a quarter million,
280,000, something like that, right?
And the substance of the argument is that in 2005 there was a bill curbing third trimester abortions. Dan Branch tried to add an amendment that would have made an exception for fetuses with irreversibly severe vital organ impairments. And that motion got tabled. They left in something with irreversibly severe brain impairments. And so Branch's team sort of argued, well, it's, you know, Paxton supported the brain thing and not the vital organ thing, so why doesn't you criticizing him for legislation that would have allowed for the termination of viable babies.
There's also a disagreement within the pro-life community or the community of pro-life activists, right? Joe Poyman is cited by the Branch campaign, and Joe Poyman of Texas Alliance for Life is right. Cited by the Branch campaign as saying that the argument made by the other side is ridiculous, but then Elizabeth Graham, I believe, is quoted as being supportive of the Paxton view of the Branch bill. I mean, there's a family disagreement within the pro-life community about
it. And there's a disagreement about – there is language in the major abortion bills that have passed recently that has stuff about severe fetal abnormalities or something. And so it's sort of like you can read into this what you want if that's significantly different from a vital organ impairment or not.
The conversation around this has seemed less about the specifics of abortion in this
less
case.
Less about abortion than journalism.
And more about
Michael Quinn Sullivan's
role as a quote-unquote journalist for Breitbart.
And to be fair to Sullivan, he did not say he was a journalist. He said, I'm on a tight deadline.
Yeah,
He's a columnist.
And he disclosed.
They did also. Disclose
is
that he...
Is he a columnist?
Well, he's writing. You can say he's writing for these guys, and you know whatever you want
to
call it. You know, he's writing.
Be a columnist.
He's writing for these guys. He is writing about the
he's
race.
He's a contributor.
He's not saying while he's writing about the race that he's participating in the race. So
the piece that ultimately ran on Breitbart on this very subject.
He did say that.
Disclosed at the bottom.
Said that,
that Sullivan's organization supports that the organization Sullivan leads. Disclosed supports Paxton.
Oh, it's not clear if they were going to do that before they got all this attention or not. But, you know, they did it, so good for them. But
and the piece is also not just authored by Sullivan. It's Sullivan and Brandon Darby and Logan Churchwell. So it's several of the other people who are contributors to Breitbart who did a joint bylined deal. And it was pretty much exactly as Sullivan represented it to the Branch campaign.
Right.
Well, I think the thing is Sullivan, long before he was a columnist or contributor or reporter for Breitbart Texas, has been sort of a – influencer in the Capitol, but you're seeing more and more people willing to strike out against him, I think.
Well, it's because his ability and his clout has increased, and as his clout has increased, so has the resistance to it.
When you become dominant,
right,
you're a target.
You know, they got to hit you back. So Bob Dole, this is playing out in the Senate District 2 race between Bob Dole and
Bob Hall.
Empower Texans, Michael Quinn Sullivan,
put a bunch of money into mailers on Hall's behalf against Duell. Duell got 40-some-odd percent, 48, something like that, and they're going into a runoff. He was a player in the Keffer race over in Keffer versus Colin Crisp, and, you know, Keffer took some swings directly at Sullivan. You know,
Jason Villalba has been effectively on a speaking tour around the state, or has now gone on a speaking tour.
The question for candidates
to attack that side maybe more than to attack Sullivan by name specifically.
It's actually sort of interesting. I mean, if you're a candidate and you're defending yourself and you find yourself attacking the supporters of your opponent instead of your opponent, you know, did they effectively draw your fire off of the opponent? You know, so, you know, one of the questions that, you know, gets answered in these races, I guess, is it an effective tactic to run against Empower Texans and Michael Quinn Sullivan, or should you just keep your eye on the ball and run against your opponent?
And honestly, is that an insider argument?
Well, that's the point, yeah.
Does anybody in the vast population outside the insiders who pay attention to this stuff, as we all do at the micro level, do they know Michael Quinn Sullivan from Adam? I mean, I don't know that, or Tim Dunn. You hear Tim Dunn's name. You know, Bob Duell was quoted in the Dallas Morning News saying Michael Quinn Sullivan and Tim Dunn are destroying the Republican Party, some version of that, in the name of conservatism.
And he had a mailer in his campaign.
But the reality is, who in the hell knows who Tim Dunn is?
Right, he had a mailer in his campaign that said
98%
of Bob Hall's money comes from one guy in Midland. Who is that guy? That was the mailer. So, you know, again, are you running against Hall, or are you running against Dunn, who's not on the ballot?
And who nobody really knows. But horizontally, the conversation is about Sullivan and those guys. Vertically, the conversation is about what is or who is journalism today. Because you've got this other story that's been playing out more sort of quiet, more quietly, but it's been playing out, where one of the affiliated Sullivan-Dunn organizations, a blog called AgendaWise, has been asking for permission to live stream at the Capitol and for, you know, effectively to be treated as the rest
floor
of the press has been.
Floor credentials,
right.
And they either are intending to sue or have sued to get access under the guise that they're no different than any other organization seeking such credentials. And so we're coming to a place where there's going to have to be, and I don't know who it is and I don't know how they do it, but there's going to have to be some kind of decision about where is the line and who gets over the line and who doesn't in terms of being considered journalism. It's a new world.
Well, they knocked
maybe
down.
Maybe a writing test.
They're not. Yeah, wow, that could be dangerous up here.
I was going to say, let's try that in our office and see who passes.
Yeah, we're going to lay off a lot of people. Right.
Then, I mean, this is sort of the fundamental thing about digital media. They knocked down the wall. You don't have to buy a printing press. Everybody has a printing press. So if everybody can, and everybody does, then what's the difference between A and B? It's just, you know,
anybody with a computer,
right,
can now say, "Hey, I'm a journalist."
Right.
Well, if anyone out there would like to submit their writing tests for credentials,
we'll
they can
press credentials to
they can send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. In the meantime, we'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music. And on behalf of Emily, Ross,
she's first,
Evan, and our producer, Todd, this
equal
is Reeve.
Outro.
Thanks for listening.
Texas Talk.
My life is too short to have to look at this shit on Twitter.